So today we are continuing through our ancient stories from the Hebrew Bible with the book of Joshua. And for some of us, Joshua is problematic. There are some good quotes in Joshua. And the name is fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. It means the exact same thing as another name you know, Jesus, which means the Lord is salvation. However, two rather distinct embodiments of that idea. For instance, you have the Gospels, which tell the stories of the Son of God who laid down his life for all the earth. And then you have today's text. And what a text to explore. Especially on the Sunday following what we now call Indigenous Peoples Day. Which, of course, is what we used to call Columbus Day. That is, until enough people's eyes were opened to the fact that Christopher Columbus, as it turns out, didn't actually discover anything other than a place already inhabited by other people, and he wasn't a very nice guy to them. While Columbus might be counted as a brave explorer in some respects, he was also a murderer and a gold-mongering pillager. Make no mistake, Christopher Columbus was a beloved child of God, just as you are and just as I am, but just as incontrovertible, he also contributed a whole lot of ugliness to the records of humanity. As did the conquistadors that followed him, as did other European settlers and colonists looking for their own quote-unquote promised land in the Americas, as did some of our presidents like Andrew Jackson, who established federal programs that drove entire people groups from the land they had called home for God knows how long, as did the earlier larger concept of manifest destiny, as did crusaders during the medieval period. And that's just a small sampling of the ugliness throughout human history, grown out from under banners with crosses emblazoned upon them. So we have grown a little bit in our understanding of what is worthy of a holiday. A little. In at least some small ways, we as humankind are becoming wiser, catching on. As a quote of the day from H.R. Niebuhr puts things, the God who reveals continues to reveal. To which I say, thanks be to God. The God who reveals continues to reveal. That is a truth to which the collective witness of our scriptures testifies and demonstrates that God is not finished, at least not yet. And we have the marvelous chance to learn, to gain in wisdom and grow toward better and better understandings by doing such things as reflecting on the past, imagining a brighter future, and engaging in dialogue. And one of the facets that to me makes the Bible such a sacred thing is the collective conversation that it contains about the very most important questions we can possibly ask ourselves, meaning of life questions, like why are we here? How are we supposed to live alongside each other? What is God like? How has God acted throughout history? Where is God in this moment? The Bible is, among many other things, a holy exercise in multivocality, with dozens and dozens of voices that have been compiled and sandwiched together inside of one binding, but nevertheless are drawn from wide-ranging cultures over the course of a bare minimum of 900 years, and that's only if you don't include the centuries of oral tradition preceding the actual pinning down of the texts. And with all of those differences come others. Differences of opinion as the children of God throughout the ages wrestle with subjects like life, death, God's will. And what on earth do I do about these other people, these people, many of whom don't act like me. Don't look like me. Don't believe what I believe, and don't get along with me. So I want to do two things today. One is to highlight that conversational, sometimes argumentative quality between biblical texts on some deeply significant stuff to which we've just got to pay attention. So listen to this passage from Isaiah 19, which is born out of a rebuilding period in Jewish history that would have been approximately like 400 years or so after the events of Joshua. And it's a passage regarding Israel's enemies. In this case, they are Assyria and, as always, Egypt. Hear this. One day Israel will be with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, also blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my heritage. That was written shortly after the Assyrian army had devastated the nation of Israel and had nearly destroyed life as the Jews had known it. And then think about the terrible history between Israel and Egypt that the Jews never forgot, that we've been over the past few weeks. And yet, the author here pictures an idyllic future that includes both of these other nations, named by God in this vision as my people and the work of my hands, right alongside Israel. That's some rather friendly stuff. Reconciliatory talk about people with which the Jews had some serious conflict and every reason to despise. And then hear these words that maybe you already know from the Gospel of Matthew, which came during a different time of persecution. Under the occupation of the Roman army about 750 years after that, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. That's even friendlier, isn't it? Don't just picture some day in the future when everyone is getting along. You love your enemies right now. Not to mention giving a certain definition of what it means to live into our identity as God's people. Not ethnicity, not where we live, but by loving others, even those that we have every reason to not. So two different texts that we desperately need to have in conversation with our story for today from Joshua, which expresses a very different worldview. a worldview that I was not excited to preach about. Paley and I signed on to this particular schedule of readings, the narrative lectionary. So as a couple, we were committed to it. But oh man, I wanted to hand this one off to her so badly. Let her preach on it. She's the one who wanted this anyway. But then she very conveniently had to go on a youth retreat in a beach house. So what I did is I thought about switching up the reading behind her back, choosing a passage from a different book. Plenty of preachers do that. And just avoid Joshua altogether. Or they remove it. So my first year at Princeton, I attended a lecture by a guest speaker named Elias Shakur. Anyone ever heard of Elias Shakur? Scott, yeah. His Excellency, Elias Shakur, is a member of a certain ancient sect of Christianity known as the Melkite Order, of which he is the Archbishop of none other than Galilee. Meaning his jurisdiction is, you know, where Jesus lived. And Shakur is a man of deep, deep, courageous faith. He was born an ethnic Palestinian in 1939, and was raised in what would become the new state of Israel 9 years later, an act that forced his family to relocate to an internment camp for some time, had his home stripped from him. He grew up, became a priest, where he continued to witness even more disenfranchisement and discrimination and bloodshed all over the same piece of promised ground, incidentally, in which the events of Joshua take place. And after returning to the Holy Land and seeing further enmity, Shakur thought he might do something regarding his would-be enemies. So he dedicated his life to advancing peace between Israelis and Palestinians. He's constantly hosting talks and forums and diplomatic discussions. He's written about the subject extensively in books such as this one right here. It's called Blood Brothers. And when he signs copies, you can't read this, but when he signs copies right next to his name, he writes the exact same phrase every time, as far as I know, which says, God does not kill. And then he has the habit of ripping Joshua out of all of his personal Bibles. For which I simply cannot pass any judgment against him. I disagree with the practice. But you can see why Joshua might hit just a little too close to home for someone in his shoes. Because it has some good stuff, but man, it is also ugly. Because it is a story not just about possession, but extermination. It is the account of a reprehensibly violent invasion, an absolutely brutal takeover. Today's passage serves as this as a fairly comprehensive summary for the whole. It comes toward the very end of the book, right before the rather peaceful death of Joshua, the military general who was the successor to the leader Moses after the Israelites had wandered around in the wilderness for what was a really long time. And the passage is a speech that recounts their history of how the Israelites came to take the promised land. And you may have noticed that it has a certain slant. First, Joshua recalls the covenant that God made with their ancestor Abraham, which was the promise of land, descendants, and blessing, so that Abraham's people might be a blessing unto others. Joshua seems to have forgotten that last part, and instead only mentions the descendants and the land, and he then narrates for all the people gathered around how they now had those two things. The Israelites were now a numerous people in a beautiful, fertile land that they had that had previously belonged to someone else. And it's not necessarily the fact that the Israelites had taken and now benefited from, as Joshua himself says, vineyards and olive yards that we did not plant. It's the fact that as Yale professor of Old Testament, Carolyn Sharp, cuts to the chase, it is nothing less than genocide. When the Israelites come into the promised land, they wipe out everyone, with rare exception. That's the goal. The Hebrew word for how they went about things is kerem, which means to ban. Objects or people designated as kerem were labeled as forbidden, needing to be cleansed, destined for total destruction. And so that's what they did. Clean slate. Enemy kings, soldiers, possessions, livestock, men, women, the old, the young. Kerem. Gone. I love the stories that we've inherited. I hold them together as a sacred whole. I learn from them. I am formed by them. Some of them are unequivocally beautiful. Some of them have saved countless lives and made even more better with their inspiration. Some are laugh out loud funny, or capture the imagination, or give voice to things in my heart that I struggle to find my own words to say. And some I struggle with because they contain things that just aren't okay. And they themselves, anyway, don't apologize for that. Some are ugly. But if we are going to, appropriate or claim the freedom to inherit the amazing, beautiful ones, then, as is the case with any family, we have to see them all with an honest look and say, you know what? We have some ugliness in our history. Some of our stories are deeply problematic. And that was the other thing that I wanted to do today, is to just confront with you how problematic at least part of one story is. One that I grew up loving, one with some really good quotes, but one that has been revealed to also be hard. To be sure, though, a story that is in conversation with others and has been pushed back against even within the bounds of the Bible itself by the later prophets of the very same people, for instance, including one by the name of Jesus, the descendant of one of the very few survivors from this conquest. Jesus, whose name, like Joshua, means the Lord is salvation, whom we are told had all heavenly powers at his disposal, yet always chose a path of peace and forgiveness, and who added words like these to the conversation: love your enemies. As in his name I pray, amen.